Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. This is Alim Mahaber. In this episode, we are grateful to be joined by David McDermott Hughes, who will be speaking on his book, Energy Without Conscience, Oil, Climate Change, and Complicity, published in 2017 by Duke University Press. David is a professor of anthropology at Rutgers University. In research and teaching, he explores ways in which people exploit each other while exploiting nature, environments, and the entire biosphere. He has written ethnography, history, and public criticism on topics as diverse as settler colonialism, racism, slavery, land reform, climate change, oil, and renewable energy in Southern Africa, the Caribbean, and the European South. He's the author of many other books, with his most recent titled Who Owns the Wind? Climate Crisis and the Hope of Renewable Energy. He's also a scholar activist, having served as president, chief negotiator, and climate justice chair of the Rutgers Faculty Labor Union. A very, very warm welcome to the podcast, David. It's great to have you on.
Thank you, Alim. I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for that introduction, too.
Fantastic. Well, first off, could you please tell me a little bit more about yourself? I guess going a bit beyond what I just said in the intro, your personal story, how you came to be who you are today, and what experiences prompted you to write the book we're talking about.
Well, your introduction was very complete. I suppose that the earlier part of my career could use some more explanation. In college, I was very involved in college in the early and mid-1980s. I was very involved in the anti-apartheid movement regarding South Africa. And that grew into an interest, an academic and political interest in Southern Africa as a whole. And so I worked in Zimbabwe in development projects after college and in Zimbabwe and Mozambique during graduate school. And I became very interested in the way in which white settler populations and their descendants were still holding land, very much in disproportion to their numbers. And through various forms of conservation, were expanding their holdings and their rights to land. So I saw conservation as kind of a neo-colonial project in Southern Africa. So I was very interested in some of the themes you mentioned, settler colonialism, race, as pursued through environmental concern. But the dictatorship of Robert Mugabe by the early 2000s made it really impossible and rather fruitless to carry out applied research in Zimbabwe. And it was at that point in the early 2000s, I was becoming very interested in climate change, which Zimbabwe is pretty marginal too, in the sense that I was interested in the drivers of climate change, the cause side of it. So I thought, let me do some ethnography in a petrostate, in a state whose economy rests on oil, gas, maybe coal. And I looked across the world for a petrostate where one could do this research. You know, it's difficult to get access to the oil ministry in say, Nigeria or Angola. But I found, first through the web and then through visits, that the Ministry of Energy and Energy Industries, as it was called then, in Trinidad and Tobago, was quite open. I found the concession map available. I found people in Petrotrin, the National Gas Company, willing, even eager to talk. So Trinidad was where I found it was. I was able to do the research on the causes and the responsibility or lack of responsibility for the climate crisis among people very responsible for it. The irony, of course, in Trinidad is that it's a small island state and therefore exceptionally vulnerable to climate change. So you have a country that is exceptionally responsible on the perpetrator side and exceptionally vulnerable on the victim side. And I wanted to see how people reconciled that contradiction. You know, and when I say exceptionally responsible, I recognize that Trinidad's aggregate emissions are, I believe they're 0.1% in terms of CO2. But per capita, Trinidad's emissions are quite high. It's the third or fourth highest per capita in the world. And of course, those national figures don't count exports. So I was very interested in how people knowledgeable about climate change and oil and gas would see their moral position in the world. And that's what the book is essentially about.
Right. There's definitely a sort of paradox there, us being an island nation allied with other low-lying countries, pushing for, you know, climate action, while simultaneously being the fourth highest per capita emitter of greenhouse gas emissions, you know? And I'm glad you pointed that out. So, well, the book is published, well, was published in 2017. It's definitely not a new book, even though we're featuring it on the New Books Network. But when I first heard about it, I, you know, became really interested because I saw, well, for one, it was researched on and written about Trinidad and Tobago, where I'm from. In fact, I'm recording this conversation in Trinidad right now. But apart from being interested in it, just on a surface level reason, I was also intrigued when I read the synopsis for the book. As the title sort of gives it away, you argue that the country engages in energy without conscience and might be complicit in climate change. You know, it just struck me as so bold. I had to interview this guy. I need to find out more. So yeah, it's definitely an interesting title and framing. Can you explain what you mean when you say energy without conscience?
Yeah, okay, that's a great question, Aleem. And since I'll have to give you a bit of a complicated answer. One of the big questions that interests me and many scholars is essentially, why do good people do bad things? And I consider the extraction and burning of oil and gas on a massive scale to be one of the worst things one can do right now. But the people I met were very kind to me. They were concerned about their families and their countries. And you would have said, these are moral people, right? And so one answer to the reason why good people do bad things, why moral people do immoral things, is that they don't see the immoral thing as being immoral or moral or being in any way a matter of ethics and conscience. And so I was interested historically in how oil failed to get this kind of ethical meaning attached to it. There's a kind of ethical deficit around it. And it's hard to see this, you know, if you're in a petrostate and if you're in the industry and so on. But I compare oil to, say, smoking, which went from being considered to be very healthy to being considered to being now in the U.S. and Europe, parts of Europe anyway, very, very denigrated, very stigmatized. Diamonds, too, have always had a kind of ethical, sort of even spiritual charge, emotional, romantic charge, whether it's positively in terms of an engagement ring or negatively in terms of the Blood Diamonds campaign. But there's a kind of banality and flatness around oil. And I actually trace it back to slavery in the Caribbean. Because it's in this period of transatlantic slavery where the concept or the format of fuel develops in the 18th century. Now the idea of a fuel is that it's a commodity. It's sold by weight or by a standard measure. It's consumable, storable, shippable, destroyable. And you never really think much about its personal qualities. I looked very carefully at the records in the Spanish colonial archives in Sevilla, in southern Spain. I looked very carefully at the records during the very end of the Spanish period when Governor Chacon was in Port of Spain. And he developed a method of measuring enslaved Africans and applying their labor on a per hectare basis. The unit of measure was fanega in that time. Anyway, a per land area basis for different crops, for sugarcane, for cotton, for coffee. And these were slaves, enslaved people worked to death and then replaced through more shipments from Africa or from within the Caribbean. And of course, eventually, people decided that that was both immoral and uneconomic, and enslaved Africans as well as politicians abolished slavery in the Caribbean. But what remained was this notion of a fuel that could be stored, transported, consumed, destroyed, and so on without ethical scruple, without ethical inquiry, you know, without a sense of doubt or wonderment at what larger concerns were at stake. And I think that what happened was that elites applied that understanding to coal, oil, and gas. And so we've always thought of them as simply consumable. And one consequence of this actually is that, in my view, you've explained that I'm an anti-oil activist. You might say, though, in one sense, I'm actually very pro-oil. I think we ought to love oil because it's got amazing qualities. And this is what I learned from experts in Trinidad. The energy density of it and gas, too, are remarkable. And I therefore hate to see people waste it and use it frivolously and throw it away, essentially. And so what ought to worry us, what ought to cause the oil lover a certain amount of regret is the way oil is wasted all the time. It's used, I mean, in the United States where I live, people just leave the engines of their cars running when they go to the supermarket and things like that. That's a horrible waste. It's also wasted because people drive their cars around unnecessarily and in the global north, heat their houses to be too hot or air condition them, sometimes in Trinidad to be too cold. We are wasting oil-derived energy all the time, which means we are disrespecting it. So I actually don't think that we should shut down the oil industry entirely, not even the fuels industry entirely. I think we should have some of it around for the stuff that's really necessary. For the ambulance that needs to accelerate fast, I think diesel or gasoline or petrol are great fuels. We should have them around and we should revere them and therefore conserve them for those essential purposes. So I probably said enough in response to your first question there, Aleem.
There's a lot of stuff to dig into there. One of the things I want to point out that's really interesting is that you're essentially examining a lack of something, you know, this lack of conscience. As you put in the book, the absence of those feelings, it presents a shape that has contours and boundaries, and that you have to sort of brush against the skin of that silence. So I'm wondering, how was the experience of exploring this negative space, or was it different from maybe your other studies, your other works, and what were the challenges of illuminating this negative space?
That's a very good question. I mean, I wrote a book about white Zimbabweans, as I said, this settler-derived population, which was left in the situation when I was doing the research around 2000, a population of 4,500 families owned about 40% of the surface area of the country and by far the best farmland in a nation of 10 or 12 million. And among those people who were very good farmers, there was often a silence about social questions, about equality. There was often a silence about African people altogether. Which people recognized very often. And there was a way that they looked away and focused instead on nature. And these were people who loved
wild animals and wild landscapes of Africa, but didn't want to think a great deal about the people. So they sort of, in a way that's almost psychological, they displaced the concern that might have been there for people onto nature. Among the oil experts and even activists that I spent time with in Trinidad, there was possibly a similar kind of displacement where people who otherwise would have been very aware of climate change and its impacts and the unequal drivers of it, instead thought a lot about the economy and focused on the way in which oil was and has developed the economy in Trinidad and Tobago and provided jobs and so on. They focused on that in a way that was almost obsessive, as a form of escapism from the moral questions around the climate crisis. And of course, the further irony there is that we know that under a business as usual scenario, carbon emissions and heat trapping and so on will destroy the economy of every country. So ultimately, the moral questions become economic if you look not that far down the road anymore, a couple of decades.
Can you tell me about the people and professions you interviewed in gathering ethnographic information for this book? Was there any particular approach you took, such as I noticed you mentioned Can you tell me about the range of people and professions you interviewed in gathering ethnographic information for this book? I think you mentioned talking to various people in government and in industry. Was there any particular approach you took? I'm curious, were there any challenges in gaining access among these different groups? Did you ever have to adjust your approach?
Okay, well, I'd say there were three groups of informants or research participants. The first were petroleum geologists and experts and policymakers in the Ministry of Energy and in Petrotrin, the natural gas company, National Gas Company, and various independent oil geologists, reservoir engineers, and so on. And I found them very open. It was only the international firms, EOG, for example, refused to see me. And I gave up on BHP Billiton after a certain point as well. But the Trinidadian firms their staff were quite open. So that was the first group. The second group is something I would call the climate intelligentsia. And that overlapped a bit with the first group, and it was constituted through a whole bunch of meetings that took place in 2009 and 2010 and leading up to 2012, maybe 2013, as I did follow-up visits. These people would convene through the kind of civil society forums that the government sponsored about climate policy. The Green Business Council was another place where this would happen. And there were various writers and authors and things and public talks. And some of this was centered around UWE, St. Augustine as well. And then finally, there were activists around La Brea. This was the time of the protest against the smelter, the proposed aluminum smelter. And I was interested there in silences as well, because what was also proposed was an electricity generating plant fired by natural gas, which was eventually built and greatly increased the carbon emissions of Trinidad and Tobago, as well as leading to ground level emissions. There was very little concern about that, and much more concern about pollution that might arise from the aluminum smelter, which in that protest was so compelling that the smelter was not built. So it was a successful protest about one kind of pollution and an almost absent protest about another kind of pollution. But I also found those people to be quite welcoming. I went to demonstrations and events, of course, and some of their meetings. And so that was the ethnography, which is the way in which an anthropologist actually participates in activities with the people being studied. I also, among all those three categories, sat down for more formal interviews or conversations with people. So those were my methods. Oh, and well, the archival methods as well. I mentioned on the historical part, I looked at the Spanish period in the archives in Spain, and for regarding the 19th century, I've spent time in the National Archives of Trinidad and Tobago, and looked quite closely at a utopian scheme from the 1840s. That involved Ivan Conrad Stolmeyer, one of the fathers of the oil industry.
Right. I want to talk to you about that. But first, you mentioned, you know, interviewing people. You seem to have talked to them, I thought, in often very frank terms, you know, and using their real names as well. You put these people, leaders, activists, politicians, those in industry, sometimes in a really bad light, is to the point where I was surprised they were okay with their remarks being published. I think at the end you said no one had any complaints or asked for any retractions. I remember being sort of surprised by that. And I remember laughing at points, and I especially liked when you directly called people out on their lack of conscience. And sometimes I saw it as hypocritical points of view. I'm hoping you could possibly relate some of the reactions you got when you confronted people. And were any of those situations frustrating for you?
Well, let me say, so that there's a kind of anthropology that we call studying up. And, you know, and in the history of anthropology, it was mostly white Europeans studying people colonized by Europe, you know, foragers, who you might call hunter-gatherers, or peasant farmers. So the anthropologist was reaching across an enormous gap of power, a racial power, class power, and reaching down that hierarchy. And you know, by the 1970s, anthropologists had gotten interested in wealthy people and powerful people as well. And so, and then I see myself as part of that tradition, and certainly studying policymakers in Trinidad and Tobago, these are wealthy and powerful people, more wealthy and powerful than me possibly. So I might have been reaching up across lines of difference, and therefore it seemed that one could have a franker conversation, a conversation that challenges. The public figures, even for wealthy people, I disguise their identity, and I'm obligated to do that by the ethical standards of my profession. But for public figures, the ethical standards are a little bit different. And so long as somebody is okay with his or her name appearing, I put the name in there. You know, I had a conversation with Patrick Manning in his office, for example, shortly after he'd lost the election in 2010. And there was no way I could disguise his identity. So your question was I frustrated? You know, I wasn't really expecting a massive change of heart. I wasn't expecting any conversion experiences on the part of my Trini informants. I did have some conversations with Krishna Prasad, the independent oil producer, where I think he came to see things differently, and I came to see things differently. He's the one that I spent the most time with and really became close to, him and his family. So I'm calling somebody out. I hope it doesn't come quite across as that, because I was looking for knowledge in every case, not to embarrass somebody. A lot of these public figures, of course, you can't interview them. You have to find them at places like the Energy Conference, which I attended a couple of times. But also, what was useful about asking a hard question at the Energy Conference is that then the odd people would see this in the audience, and people would come up and say, "Oh, who are you? And you know, where do you come from? And that was a good question," or "I hated your question," and lead to further conversations with third parties in the room.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. Well, maybe calling it out was the wrong framing, but you definitely confronted them on some very difficult questions that they probably haven't reconciled with before. I thought that was very interesting to see in those reactions. Well, one of those wealthy and powerful public figures, as you said, at least historically, was Conrad Stallmeyer. The name is fairly well known in Trinidad. Growing up, I always heard about him, but never really knew anything about him, really. But I never imagined solar-powered robots would be a part of his story. So why was it important for the book to focus on this particular historical figure? What role did he play in Trinidad's modern the energy sector in terms of developing its lack of conscience and its complicity?
Yeah, so this gets back to part of what I said about how oil has this kind of banal, flat, amoral connotations around it. And the chapter regarding Stallmeyer is written in a kind of experimental way, where I'm looking at something that didn't happen. You know, the book, as you said, is about silences, about absences, about how oil had an opportunity to gain this kind of romantic, even utopian meaning. But because of certain things that Stallmeyer did, oil developed in this amoral conscienceless way. And so what Stallmeyer did was he hooked up with a guy called Adolphus Etzler, who was a utopian from Germany by way of Britain. And they were interested in abolishing somatic power, abolishing human labor, and replacing it with machines. They were followers of the French utopian Charles Fourier. This was all happening in the 1830s, 1840s. And the machines that they imagined would have been solar powered or possibly wind powered. And Stallmeyer and particularly Etzler were abolitionists as well. So they wanted to abolish the labor, the enslavement and the labor of enslaved people. They wanted to abolish the necessity for working class people to do manual labor. And they brought everybody. They brought about 45 people over to the opposite shore from Trinidad in the Gulf of Venezuela. It's now Venezuela, to a utopian settlement. And those people waited for the machine to arrive. This was in about 1844 to 1845. The machine never came because it couldn't actually be constructed. And this was really Adolphus Etzler in some way swindling Stallmeyer, although really it's not clear how much Stallmeyer knew and when he knew it. And then a lot of those people died of various diseases, and the survivors slumped back to Port of Spain, and their ancestors may still be in Trinidad. But Stallmeyer in Port of Spain then, in the late 1840s, going into the 1850s, got hooked up with the Pitch Lake and various experiments of how to make kerosene from pitch. And kerosene, as we know, can be a fuel for motive power, but also it can be a fuel in the sugarcane refineries, in the usine,
and replace stover or bagasse, sometimes called megasse, you know, the crop residues, and the use of that fuel, of kerosene, would make the labor of the guy who shovels the bagasse into the, would obviate his labor, right? That person wouldn't be necessary anymore because you could basically have a pipe and you could put the kerosene there. And that worst and most dangerous and most hellishly hot job in the whole sugar commodity chain could be abolished. So I was interested in why this didn't happen. Because what Stolmeyer did was he sent kerosene to street lamps in Port of Spain and did not use it to relieve labor, right? So, and this is what's happened generally with fossil fuels, is that this, and as I say, I'm a great lover of fossil fuels. They could be used to actually replace most of the manual labor we do. And that hasn't happened because they've been used instead to allow each worker to produce more stuff. And they've led to this incredible consumer boom of things that people mostly don't need and very rapidly don't want anymore, consumables. And so we see this interesting point where Stolmeyer had the right ideas, but he lost them in 10 or 20 years. And he no longer wanted to, after the abolition of slavery, he no longer wanted to abolish labor altogether. And so he diverted the potential of oil elsewhere. And the reason, part of the reasons he did that, I'm surmising by the end of the chapter, is that he, although being an abolitionist, he was not an anti-racist. He was very much of a racist. And what he particularly didn't like after abolition was, after emancipation, was the sight of Afro-Trinidadians lounging around and not working. So he wanted to make sure people did work. And so he kind of became pro-labor at that point.
It was really interesting, like, seeing the ideals of his youth change, being someone who I think advocated for having no labor, and then, like, maybe because of his experiences, I think, as you said, seeing the idleness of the slaves, and that sort of changed his whole outlook, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, I'm interested, you know, Paul Lafargue, the 1890s, turn of the century socialist, is an interesting figure to me. He wrote a book then at that point called The Right to Be Lazy, making the argument that we have enough machines now that we really don't need to work. And why should we think of work as the ultimate value of human life anyway? So one of the frustrating things to me is that when we have all this energy abundance and we're not putting it into uses that would alleviate human toil or human suffering, we're putting it into uses that make people work harder and possibly suffer more.
Well, the right to be lazy is definitely something I often practice. I want to go through some of the other ideas you explored in the book. Often brought up was what you referred to as a myth of inevitability with regard to the petroleum industry. Can you explain what this myth is about?
Yeah, so this came out of conversations with people like Krishna Prasad, petroleum geologists and various kinds of executives in oil companies, both parastatal and private. And, you know, I would put this kind of challenging set of questions around, you know, given that we all know that climate, that the extraction and then the burning of hydrocarbons drives climate change, why are you still doing it? You know, why don't you stop? And, you know, these are people, I mean, I have the greatest respect for the expertise of Trinidad's oil and gas experts. I mean, they have been influential on a global scale in the monetization of gas, particularly in Africa. So these are consequential people that I was posing this question to. And they would say, well, that oil is coming up. And I'd say, well, what do you mean it's coming up? And then they would give me a whole disquisition often on how natural pressure and gravitational sorting are always pushing hydrocarbons towards the surface. And most of them over geological time do come up through the surface, through seeps, often underwater, leading to these kinds of things you call tar balls on the beach and stuff like that. And of course, if you're in South Trinidad, you're obviously going to believe that oil's coming up naturally because our hydrocarbons are coming up naturally because that's what you see at the Pitch Lake. And they said all we're doing when we drill is recreating what nature does. We're piercing the cap rock or the trap and releasing or recovering, you might say. The terms are very interesting in the oil industry, recovering those hydrocarbons that were trapped. And so I spent a lot of time reviewing the whole history of petroleum geology, and particularly the way stratigraphic diagrams were developed, and then the way they were merged with, you might say, or the way their iconography was then carried over into something called the Petroleum Resource Management System, which is a chart about oil reserves and resources. And that chart also naturalizes or makes it seem normal that oil and gas should always be produced. And what I realized in the course of this is that we're not about to run out of oil and gas. There's always more, and we call the stuff that's the great big vast ocean of it the resources. And what we tend to talk about in public are the reserves. But resources, through this process that's deemed to be natural, are always crossing the threshold and becoming reserves. So I was interested in this kind of merging of economic and geological categories, where the geologist was often thinking in economic terms. And therefore thinking that to the extent that markets are inevitable, then oil production is also inevitable. And extraction, the upward movement, the artificial upward movement of oil, is also something that somebody is going to do and can't be stopped. And so this contributes to this sense of this amoral sense around oil, is that if all you're doing is helping nature, then that can't be such a bad thing.
All right. One of the other concepts you explore is petropastoralism. I want to know how did it manifest? Well, one of the concepts you explore is petropastoralism, specifically in regard to the thinking of several prominent environmental activists in the country. I believe you refer to them as those people belonging to the climate intelligentsia, and specifically involved environmental issues such as the proposed but ultimately abandoned project of the aluminum smelter in Labre, South Trinidad, and the rapid railway project that would connect San Fernando to Port of Spain. Can you talk about this?
So the pastoral is a kind of aesthetic movement which has gone on for centuries in British literature, at any rate, where certain landscapes, maybe agricultural landscapes, are thought of as being natural, beautiful, natural, bucolic. And so agriculture, which is artificial, can be represented as being natural and can carry with it that inspiration, that sense of freedom that from the 19th century onwards, British people have felt around nature. So I wanted to import to Trinidad some of that framework. And what I was trying to explain is why fossil fuels, hydrocarbons, seem natural to so many Trinidadians. And so the first test case of that was around the smelter battle, which I talked about. The smelter battle, which also involved the construction of a gas-fired power plant, and all of it on a landscape that had been quite transformed already decades earlier through the oil industry, so much so that the ponds that were then destroyed to make way for the smelter the ponds were actually formed by water brought up with oil, that's produced water, heavily polluted water. But people were describing that landscape as being natural. And as I was saying earlier, it's seems that you could believe that because there is oil coming up, or asphalt at any rate, coming up naturally around the Pitch Lake. So there's a kind of continuum from the natural oil to the natural gas plant. And all of that seems to be almost beyond reproach from environmentalists. So that environmentalists were protesting of things to them that seemed unnatural and seemed toxic and harmful. So beginning with the smelter and ending with the Rapid Rail project, I was really rather disappointed that Rapid Rail did not get built.
Me too. I was as well.
I did believe the predictions that it would reduce carbon emissions very dramatically, improve air quality, allow people to get from St. Augustine, say, or Piarco to Port of Spain, very rapidly and pleasantly. But people saw it as a mega project. So I was interested in this concept of mega project and how the scale of a project didn't seem to fit. The large scale of a project like Rapid Rail didn't seem to fit with the small scale of the island of Trinidad. And I saw in this a whole lot of ideology, which I called then the petro-pastoral, a pro-oil ideology that almost made oil seem natural, oil and its infrastructure seem natural and beautiful, and made other infrastructures seem ugly, gigantic, and out of place. That's what that chapter is essentially about.
Right. And I want to move on to another concept you talked about as well, what you termed the victim slut. And I want to know how did Trinidad fit into this?
Oh, yeah. I'm glad we're talking about that. So I was doing this research around the time of the Conference of Parties to the Kyoto Protocol that was occurring in Copenhagen in 2009, but a month before that, the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting occurred in Port of Spain, and Patrick Manning treated that CHOGM as a sort of dress rehearsal for the COP, and therefore the CHOGM focused a great deal on climate change, and Trinidad presented itself there, the government presented itself there as a victim of climate change, and Trinidad, having joined the Association of Small Island States, also presented itself diplomatically, geopolitically, as a victim of climate change. And as I explained at the outset, that's only half the story. The other half of the story is to be a perpetrator of climate change. And surely anybody with some sophistication could hold these two ideas in his or her head at the same time and say, well, we're in this business of kind of shooting a gun with our hand and hitting our foot all the time, doing two things at once. But it seemed there was something about victimhood that excluded perpetratorhood in the way most of my informants talked about it, in the way the media talked about it as well. And there was a perverse element, because as I followed these discourses, what I saw was that the oil and gas industry itself in Trinidad positioned itself as vulnerable to climate change and as a victim of climate change. And this is because so much of its infrastructure is close to sea level that it's threatened by sea level rise, storm surges, things like that. But all that is true, but those kinds of arguments and appeals kept silencing the part wherein the oil and gas industry was causing the same harm. So that's what I mean by a slot. It's a kind of simplifying device where it becomes very hard for people to see the moral complexity around your role when you claim victimhood to climate change.
Right. David, I hope you could allow me to indulge in playing devil's advocate for a moment, because you often address pushback and criticism of your ideas in the book, right? I think bringing this up would make for an interesting discussion, right? So often in repudiation of your argument, people brought up the fact that Trinidad contributes less than 0.1% to global CO2. And as the book mentions, this was a talking point of the late Prime Minister we interviewed, the Honorable Dr. Patrick Manning. So I'm wondering, bringing up in line with what he said, shouldn't we really be paying attention to, the developed world, the global corporations there that contribute mostly to global CO2 emissions, rather than the minuscule amounts produced by a small island petrostate like Trinidad? I'm wondering, how does the book address this?
Oh, yeah. Well, I certainly don't think we should let off countries of the global north and their industries and corporations. I certainly don't think we should let them off the hook by any means. And much of my activism is focused entirely in the United States on those kinds of actors, against those kinds of actors. But one of the presumptions behind the book is that the nation state is not the only unit of analysis. You know, when you have a twin island state or any island state, it's easy to think of the nation state as being the only relevant unit of analysis because of the way the landform kind of contains your identity. But we know that the oil and gas industry is global. I did interview people at BPTT, which is, of course, a subsidiary of BP. And I guess I would say that the argument that your small contribution in absolute terms removes responsibility is something anybody could actually use that argument. You know, BP globally, I'm not sure what their emissions are, but it's smaller than the United States or China. So BP could say, well, we're just small. You know, we're like Trinidad and Tobago. We're just small. ExxonMobil, maybe they're just small. They don't actually burn a lot of oil and gas. They just bring it out of the ground. Anybody, any individual or group or town could also say its emissions are small. And so you could take apart larger units such as China and break it down into smaller parts, and then each one of those smaller parts would say we're small. And remember, Trinidad's boundaries themselves are only an accident of politics, beginning with the breakup of the British Empire and with the failure of the Federation of the West Indies. So I wouldn't treat Trinidad as a natural unit of analysis. In any case, mostly I was talking about to individuals about their own sense of responsibility. And those could be people. Those could be people in the oil and gas sector anywhere in the world.
Right, right. Okay, well, building on that last point, talking about individuals, well, what is your prescription? I think you mentioned it in the conclusion. How should we move forward knowing this energy without conscience is taking place? And as you mentioned, we can't just stop oil production. Do you or the book propose any ideas on how we might move forward?
Well, I didn't say we can't just stop oil production. I said we shouldn't stop it 100%. We could stop it 99%. I'm concerned about the conditions for life on planet Earth. And I've become even more concerned about them since writing the book. And so I start any consideration of this question with what do we need to do to survive? And particularly, what do we need to do for the most vulnerable people? Some of whom are in Trinidad and Tobago, some of whom are in a city like Georgetown. Guyana is very vulnerable. Bangladesh, Vietnam, Pakistan now, incredibly vulnerable populations. What do we need to do for them to survive? And it seems like we need to stop burning hydrocarbons. That is what the dynamics of the atmosphere are dictating. And the atmosphere doesn't negotiate with us. It doesn't reason. So we have hard constraints.
And so let's work from that, from those hard constraints, let's work out what a political and economic program for survival can be. So it involves ceasing to burn oil, gas, and coal very rapidly. Not 100%, but 99%. You know, Trinidad has a lot to consider as a petrostate, whose economy depends so much on oil and particularly gas. Various people going back to the Green Business Council have proposed alternative industries. Fertilizer, for example, is a big hydrocarbon product that agriculture is still going to need. You can make it from hydrogen, green hydrogen from seawater, possibly using electricity generated from wind or sunlight. Trinidad would seem ideally positioned to harvest those renewable resources and put them into producing fertilizer, right? Replacing the kind of Haber-Bosch process that Methanex and Yara and so on use. All right, and there, why not do that? That's an economic industry that Trinidad is as well positioned, possibly even better positioned to do that than to continue producing gas. Right? So I won't say that kind of transition would be without disruption or without unemployment. And it's very easy for me to talk about this as a nicely employed professor in New Jersey. But any of the disruption that we're talking about in moving rapidly away from fossil fuels is a whole lot more survivable than climate change under business as usual. There's a question of economic disruption versus global apocalypse. I would choose economic disruption any day, and I think anybody sensible would.
Well, on that note, I think we'll end the discussion on energy without conscience. Before we go, I want to ask you, is there any material you have out or that you're currently working on that would you like to share? Anything that's next for you?
Well, sure. You mentioned the book about wind power, Who Owns the Wind? It's an examination of opposition to wind farms in a Spanish village surrounded by wind turbines. But it's really making arguments about who should own wind and what kind of property regime would be most likely to promote the energy transition. And I'm arguing for public ownership or common ownership of the wind as a way of getting more allies and more support for wind power to replace and retire fossil fuels. What probably is most accessible to people actually are some chapters of that book came out in an online free magazine called Boston Review. I've also got more recent pieces on solar energy and forms of ownership of solar energy. My latest work has not come out. I'm studying civil disobedience movements against fossil fuels in the northeastern U.S. So people can keep a lookout for that. I may publish an article pretty soon in Boston Review on that. So I have a page, an author page in Boston Review, and a lot of stuff comes out there. That's a good place to. And I have, of course, my own website, a WordPress site under David McDermott Hughes. So that's a good idea, a good way to keep up with my latest stuff without a paywall.
Well, I definitely will, David. I want to thank you for engaging me in conversation about your book and Energy Without Conscience. And maybe for your future books, we could have a conversation again.
I'd be happy to do that, Aleem. Thank you. And thank you to the folks listening to the show.
All right. Bye, David. You have a good one.
Okay. You too.